good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 610 of Unwelcome Guests, From Enclosure to Privatisation. I'm Robin Upton. We have three pieces for you this week. Firstly, on enclosure. Secondly, on privatisation. And thirdly, a resumption of our readings from David Graeber's Debt, the first 5,000 years, and he'll be focusing on the Middle Ages. To begin the show, this is a recording from 2012 by C.S. Sung of Against the Grain.
It's fair to say that Peter Linebaugh is obsessed. His obsession is with things we all share or should share in common, and also with the process of that sharing, the activity of sharing, using, laboring, subsisting. Systems of privatization and of what is called enclosure are deeply inimical to this commons and commoning, and in many of Linebaugh's writings, he highlights the determined resistance of people to dispossession. Resistance of this kind has occurred more frequently and with more conviction and courage than most realize, as, for example, when the Luddites went about smashing machines in northern England 200 years ago. And if we dial it back to the early 1200s, yes, 8 centuries ago, we find, or Linebaugh finds for us, popular resistance that resulted in the creation of a singular and in many ways radical document, the Magna Carta. Peter Linebaugh is a social historian at the University of Toledo and the author of a new pamphlet called Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, and an award-winning book called The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. When Linebaugh joined me in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I began by asking if Ned Ludd, from whom the Luddites drew and draw their inspiration, was a real person or a mythological one.
Mythological, C.S. Sometimes you will find people referring to an apprentice of the 1770s who broke a machine named Ned Ludd. Not the machine, but the apprentice, of course. But there's no historical accuracy to this that we know about. So Ned Ludd was a figure of an avatar of the English working class at first.
So people in northern England in the early 1800s, they take up hammers in the name of this mythological person to smash machines. What kind of machines?
Yeah, three machines. Steam engine-powered a weaving machine in Lancashire. That's one. There was a cropping machine in the West Riding of Yorkshire, a shearing machine. And then in Nottinghamshire, the third point in the Luddite triangle, there was a framework knitting machine. These were the initial machines of the Luddites of 1811, 1812.
And what did they have against these machines?
Nothing personal, as it were. The artisans of the time were very close to their tools. They understood that tools mediated their own creativity with their craft. No, these machines were introduced for the sole purpose of increasing profit for the masters or the capitalists of English manufacturing. And those profits were obtained at the expense of working class communities, the families of artisans, the apprenticeship of artisans, the communities of artisans and the skills of artisans. These are what they wish to preserve, especially subsistence.
How many people were engaged in this smashing of machines back then?
Oh, I'm not sure anyone has done a quantification, and I'm not sure it's possible to do because it was a clandestine and surreptitious or secret form of opposition. It had to be. Trade unions were illegal. Assemblies of more than 15 people were illegal. it was very difficult to organize among those who were proletarians, the vast majority of people. But the Luddites were a minority within that class of hundreds. You know, it depends on the community. Some, I think the main thing to remember about the Luddites is that while there might be a few burly, rebellious men who would smash a machine, they were protected by their village communities. And the authorities had no way of penetrating the bonds in these communities. So this would it wasn't a moral issue, as we might think, but it was an issue of community and class solidarity. And this means there was no oral record. You know, the best that the authorities could do would be to send provocateurs. There was a notorious provocateur, Oliver. But the danger of the evidence of provocateurs, it's in their self-interest to have crimes occur.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the Luddites' actions were crimes. From their point of view, they were upholding an older customary economy.
Now, in your new pamphlet, Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, and we'll talk about what Queen Mab is, who this person is, what the poem is a bit later, you link this tool breaking to the process of enclosure. Now, what is enclosure, and to what extent was it occurring back in the late 18th and early 19th centuries in the places where the Luddites lived?
Yeah, this is really fundamental. There are many types of enclosure, but when we refer to the English enclosure movement, its parliamentary form occurred really between 1760 and 1830. That is, at the time of the French, Haitian, American revolutions. And it put common land, it privatized the land of England. One of the great historians of enclosure, Jeanette Neeson, refers in a powerful phrase to the closing of England. She imagines England as being the land, and the land was shut off from the people by fences, by hedges, by ditches, by no trespassing signs, by even man traps, to prevent access to land which formerly had provided subsistence resources for commoners. So the enclosure movement is really a destruction of the commons. That's one form of enclosure, but at the same time, there were other types of enclosures. England was imprisoned. That is, new prisons were built. Barracks were set up for the army, which formerly had been billeted in inns and public houses. That is, it had been mixed with the population. There was mental types of enclosure, such as dictionaries and grammars and the correct way of speaking English. And there was widespread censorship of ideas. So we can take this notion of enclosure of the land and spread it even to the factories themselves, which were being erected in the early 19th century as a type of enclosure. Shipping was put behind huge walls so that ports came to look like fortifications in Liverpool and in London.
And what happened to the craftsman workshop under this system of enclosure, which encouraged the production of factories?
Well, the craftsman's workshop as a whole disappears, though for niche production, for luxury goods, it will remain. But on the whole, production of manufactured items ceases to be by the hand. It becomes the machine begins to take over, and skilled artisans became largely machine tenders or machine minders. And thus, the factory became the place of exploitation of the unskilled, of notoriously of children. Women in the textile, in the spinning factories, steam-powered machines looked after by women. So women and children suffered from the imperfections of these machines, the noxious gases, the noxious filaments from spinning.
What did the mechanization of labor have to do with expropriation from the commons? How do you tie this introduction of machines and larger machines to the enclosure movement?
Oh, C.S., that is really a very important question, a very fundamental question. And the relationship between enclosure and mechanization, yes, the two go hand in hand. Apart from the mechanization of the field with the steam-powered threshing machine, which was opposed in the Captain's Swing riots, which were a Luddite form of destruction of machines in the 1830s, the relationship was indirect between mechanization and enclosure. They both had the effect of devaluing the working person, devaluing her labors, devaluing her skills. And they both also contributed to the growth of the urban proletariat and thus of the notorious slums of the disenfranchised early cities like Manchester or Leeds or parts of London.
That's the voice of Peter Linebaugh. He's a social historian who teaches at the University of Toledo. And he's got a new pamphlet out entitled Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, Machine Breaking, Romanticism, and the Several Commons of 1811-1812. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You mentioned earlier, Peter, the building of prisons. So what about the process of enclosure encouraged or promoted the building of jails?
Well, in a literal sense, the jail is an enclosure. You can't get out of it once you're stuck in it. You're sunk to do time. And this concept of doing time is an attempt to reform the soul, to use the language of prison reformers at the time. But it's actually a type of isolation and torture to destroy the ability to organize and to think clearly among prisoners. These great prisons were erected really from the 1790s right up through the 1830s. It was a massive prison building program all over the British Empire, also especially in England, in London, in Dartmoor. There is, as Michel Foucault termed it, a carceral archipelago in a marvelous expression. The Kilmainham Jail in Dublin, a famous place of rebels, revolutionaries, and malcontents, was also built at this time. So your question was, what's the relationship between the prisons and the enclosure? The other main relationship between them is the criminalization of customary commoning. That is, people would use the land or use the forest as a place to derive subsistence by taking wood for particular purposes or by growing plants for particular purposes with neighbors, with others, and to self-manage this commoning. But when that land or resources are privatized, then those practices become criminalized. In other words, the person who sets up the hedge also hammers into the earth a no trespassing sign. And with that sign, if you're found trespassing or otherwise persisting in traditional practices of commoning, which now seem to be taking what doesn't belong to you. So that results in convictions of theft, which result in punishment, which during this period is transformed from hanging and other physical punishment, other punishments directly on the body, to forms of enclosure in prison construction. You know, just utterly abhorrent forms of treating human beings in such torturous isolation cells.
And the criminalization happened as well on the docks and on the ports. And you mentioned earlier sort of enclosure meant a rise in infrastructure around the ports, these large buildings. Can you talk a little bit about the people who worked and lived on the sea and to what degree that population might have drawn from, might have derived from people expropriated from the land and what their consciousness might have been?
That's a great question, because the people on the sea are an international people. The working class in England comes from all over the world. You know, perhaps a fifth of the Royal Navy at this time of the Napoleonic Wars, perhaps a fifth of it was African-American. 60% of the merchant marine was from the East Indies. That is, they'd be from Bengal or Malaya or from China. These would be skilled sailors who were picked up and forced on board under coercive circumstances in the ports of the British Empire in Bengal, India, or what's now Bangladesh, South Asia, and East Asia. They'd come to London and other ports and be beached. That is, there would be no place for them to go, except into types of enclosures. You know, now that we're talking about that theme, like in 1811, there was thousands of beached Lascars who were confined in boarding houses that were little better than prisons.
And Lascars were from Bengal?
Yes, mm-hmm. They were. So what I'm trying to convey is that this is a terraquitous proletariat. That means it's both of the land and of the sea. And it's an international proletariat, which is divided by language, but quickly learns how to ask, do you have any food? Or can I share this with you? In other words, quickly develops an international language among themselves, known as Sabir, in the Mediterranean.
Peter Linebaugh joins us in our KPFA Berkeley studios. He's a professor of history at the University of Toledo. Let's talk about a poet named Percy Bysshe Shelley. He was born in 1792. He died in 1822, so he was, of course, alive during the Luddite risings in 1811, 1812 that you address in this new pamphlet. So Shelley figures prominently in your pamphlet. He wrote a poem, a long poem, called Queen Mab, which is part of the title of your pamphlet. Maybe before we get to Queen Mab, he at one point wrote a broadside called A Declaration of Rights. What did that document say that was of relevance to the Luddites?
Yeah, listen to this. It's 31 rights. He put them in a bottle and tossed them in the sea.
Really?
Yeah, then he put them in a hot air balloon and launched them into the atmosphere. These were the media of communication for Shelley. Anyway, 31 rights, and the right at the beginning is the rights of man are liberty and equal participation of the commonage of nature. So when I saw that word commonage, I thought right away, because this is 1811, at that same time, Ned Ludd, the general of the Army of Redressors, swore to put down all machinery hurtful to the commonality and repeal that to hang frame breakers. But we petition no more. That won't do. Fighting must. This is what Ned Ludd said. So Ludd is defending the commonality. Percy Bysshe Shelley, at the same time, is calling for an equal participation in the commonage of nature. And I think that this poetic and romantic expression of the of rights, on the one hand, on the other, the Luddites' reference to their communities and their commons, on the other hand, is a very powerful conjunction of human thought and human action at a time of world crisis. It points to roads not taken.
Meaning?
Meaning, people like Shelley are looking for, to them, equality is an economic matter. They don't refer to equality of opportunity. They refer to an equal participation in the commonage of nature. So they're English communists at this time, like Thomas Spence or Maurice Margarot, or there are others who believe that the land is made for all and who are opposing enclosures at the level of ideas, not just at the level of action or the level of customary preservation. They are thinking about this, and it's from this thought of Thomas Spence and Percy Bysshe Shelley, to a lesser extent, that English communism is renewed.
Queen Mab was Shelley's long poem published in 1813. What did Shelley inveigh against in this poem?
He inveighs against private property. He inveighs against authoritarianism. He inveighs against male chauvinism. He inveighs against meat-eating. He inveighs against a monotheistic, cruel god. These are some of the subjects he inveighs against, which he does in the name of Queen Mab, the Irish deity or semi-deity who sends us our dreams. She's a warrior deity, and she's a deity of the earth. As Mercutio has a huge and beautiful speech in Romeo and Juliet describing Queen Mab. But this is the Shelley, like Hegel at the same time, was a strong believer in the action of spirit in world history. And for Shelley, Queen Mab was the way he expressed this.
So what does Shelley have against commodities and machines?
They dehumanize humans. May I read you from Queen Mab just briefly?
Please.
Let the axe strike at the root. The poison tree will fall. The war is the business of kings and priests who conceal their selfishness with free words. To Shelley, the machine encouraged slavishness. Like, listen to this. Power, like a desolating pestilence, pollutes whatever it touches. And obedience, bane of all genius, virtue, freedom, truth, makes slaves of men. And of the human frame, a mechanized automaton.
He alludes as well to the moral economy, which was disappearing. What rules of conduct governed that moral economy?
The rule of conduct there is that none should want while others profit. In the simplest terms, that's the main rule of the moral economy. In other words, there is to be no profiteering from buying and selling of food until the poor have had a chance to make their purchases. This goes back to the birth of capitalism in the 16th century and the legislation against engrossing, forestalling, and regrating. And these are all merchandising terms of ways to raise the price of goods so that the margin of profit can swell. The problem with this is that as the price rises, more and more of the poor, of the unwaged or the poorly waged, can no longer make purchases of survival.
Now, we've been talking about Luddism in England in the 19th century, in 1811, 1812, and the constellation of people and writers and seafarers at that time. Let's jump the Atlantic. A lot of people might not think Luddism was popular or was being acted upon in the U.S. at this time, but you argue differently.
I do. I think this is a really important theme. We think that the U.S. and Europe is separated, you know, by a huge ocean, and therefore the people must be separated. However, the people are united and are organized by capitalism in the first place. That is, the people who grew the cotton are the slaves on the plantations of the American South. The people who spun the cotton and who wove the cotton were the workers we've been discussing in England. But you see how the cotton itself unites them. Furthermore, the profiteering is united by the organization of this international trade. The same goes with sugar, by the way, and the history of the sugar plantation in South America and in the West Indies. So from the standpoint of these products, the people making and refining and manufacturing them are all in the same process. What I found is that whether we consider the independence movement in Venezuela of 1811 or the Hidalgo Revolt of 1810-1811 in Mexico, or the largest slave revolt in American history up to that time in Louisiana in 1811, an element in all of them was the destruction of the tools of oppression. Again, I want to emphasize that the tools that workers respect tools, perhaps more than anyone else, because they're extensions of their own hands, of their own bodies. Mm. But when those tools are separate from them and are used for the purpose of making them work longer, or for the purpose of intensifying their labor, or of dividing their labor from others, such as their children, apprentices, or their families, then it's quite reasonable to expect, and indeed we find, destruction of those tools. We find it among the Laneros of Venezuela. We find it among the Aztec of the communal property holders of Mexico. We find it among the Creek and Choctaw Indians of the American South. And we find it among the slaves of Virginia, whose plows were redesigned by northern manufacturers to be unbreakable. And there was a different plow designed for the slave than for the so-called free pioneer, the slaves being much heavier, much more cumbersome. And then in the Louisiana Revolt of 1811, tools also were used as not only to be destroyed, but they might be transformed to be used as weapons in the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So I found really with the Luddites in 1811, 1812 is a transatlantic and also Mediterranean struggle against exploitation. And one of the means of that struggle was the destruction of tools.
Peter Linebaugh is an historian who teaches at the University of Toledo. He's also taught at, among other places, Attica Penitentiary and the Federal Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. Linebaugh's new pamphlet is entitled Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, and one of his books is The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. And before we leave this pamphlet, I want to ask you about modern analogs. So we have some machines back in the early 19th century, which, as you've pointed out, constitute attacks on workers, attacks on communities, attacks on the commons. In what machines or technology currently do you see analogs in terms of their socioeconomic impact?
Well, this is something that I think every listener will have an answer to.
No doubt.
Yes, but the one that leaps to mind and gave the whole world a jolt was the Fukushima disaster in Japan and the utter unpreparedness of the Japanese state, the Japanese energy conglomerates to deal with it, and the popular response, very often led by mothers and housewives, to discover the extent of the contamination and poisoning of the earth and waters and perhaps sky in different parts of northern Japan. And this is of a people for whom this is not their first disaster with nuclear energy. The people who have suffered from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, surely one of the greatest deliberate crimes of human history.
Let's turn now to your book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. It was published by University of California Press. And maybe we could start this way. And actually, there's a lot of connections between that book and the pamphlet we've just been talking about. Your interest in the commons, in liberties, against expropriation, the emphasis placed on forests and communities. But why a book on Magna Carta if, as you acknowledge in your book, Magna Carta has been venerated for eight centuries?
Well, I think the important parts of Magna Carta in recent years have been utterly forgotten, especially the prohibition of torture, especially the right of justice and trial by jury, especially habeas corpus, you know, of not locking people up without giving a reason. These are fundamental parts of the due process of law, itself a phrase from Magna Carta, which we find in the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment and in other parts of the U.S. Constitution. So because they had been forgotten in the crisis that led to the invasion of Iraq and the continuing crisis of the American penal system from Guantanamo Bay to Pelican Bay, I felt it, you know, a small way as an English historian to remind people that, look, this Magna Carta has played a big role in human history, has played a very big role in American history, in the history of the abolition of slavery, has played a big role in the formation of the English working class movement, and has played a big role in other parts of the world, from Palestine to Barbados to South Africa to Singapore. It's a part of legal traditions. But I wanted to make this tradition live. And when I went looking, C.S., what I found out utterly astonished me in that this Magna Carta, this big charter of in the Middle Ages, was also accompanied by a little charter, the Charter of the Forest, which spoke about the regulation of the principal energy source of that time, which was wood. So the Charter of the Forest had to do with commoning. It had to do with common people's subsistence. And even Magna Carta refers to the common in Chapter 7 when it talks about the right of estovers for widows.
And what are estovers?
Estovers is access to fuel, and in that case, it's access to wood. This is an era before nuclear energy, before petroleum, before coal, when wood was the principal way that people kept themselves warm. The principal way they cooked their food was over wood fires. Also, wood was the principal building material. So to have access to wood was to have access to life, access to warmth, also access to health. The woods is a pharmacopoeia, really.
And you refer, in fact, to the kind of long-standing image of women out in the forest picking up twigs, picking up sticks off the commons and using them for subsistence, for getting by.
That's right. That's right. A task of cold and brutal drudgery. Hardened to hope, insensible to fear, scarce living pulleys of a dead machine, mere wheels of work and articles of trade. So I'm reading from Shelley again, and then Shelley earlier had described such a woman. Wordsworth had described such a woman. Even George Orwell in 1939 saw some Moroccan woman carrying wood, and he thought they were of a different race entirely. What I conclude from this is that these observations, which come down to us from white men, to speak exactly, is that they don't talk to the women and ask them, by what right or why do you take this wood? What are you going to use it for? And if they did, then there could ensue a discussion about customary takings, about forms of commoning. And all those people, you know, who think, oh, the commons is pie in the sky, or oh, the commons is just dreaming, or oh, the commons is just romanticism, if they actually stopped and talked with commoners, in this case women gathering fuel, they might learn something about the practicality of subsistence and of sharing.
Your book reminds us that the Magna Carta was forced upon a king of England, King John, in a meadow along the Thames in 1215. 1215, a long time ago. And it was, you write, the proud product of rebellion. There were barons rebelling against King John, and this was sort of the way that conflict was settled. Now, if that's true, why does this document refer to the commons and to widows Estovers, the rights of women to continued access to the commons?
That's a really good question. And the answer to it, I think, is simple. History is written by the victors. If there's any accomplishment we peasants, we proletarians, we workers, we common people, we slaves, if we've made any victory in the past, the working class will claim that they gave it to us.
So you mean the ruling class?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The ruling class will say they gave it to us. But far from that being the case, if we look at history from below, we will see that the rebellion, the anti-war rebellions during the civil wars of the 13th century was the background to the church and state quarrels, to the quarrel between monarchy and the barons from which Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest resulted.
Your book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, is a fascinating history of Magna Carta, the ideas, the provisions through the course of many centuries in many places around the world. I want to take you to the 17th century, during which you write that the Magna Carta was transformed from a medieval document rarely cited, though frequently confirmed, into a modern constitutional law. Can you tell us a little bit about this development?
I think the principle of it is Edward Cook. He's the main jurist whose Institutes of Law was the foundation for U.S. legal studies through Blackstone and through Washington, Madison, Jefferson, and so on. Edward Cook is the one who transformed medieval privileges into modern rights through Magna Carta. And he was able to put meat and power and force into this transformation because of the levelers, because of John Lilburn and the struggles of the English Revolution of the 1640s, than which there is perhaps no historical episode more important for understanding the expropriation of the commons and the bourgeois republic that was formed.
Right, the levelers being, and you can correct me if I'm mistaken, but this was a popular movement. It stressed people's sovereignty, equal rights, religious tolerance. This was the mid-17th century, correct?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And so in that atmosphere, what you're saying is Cook was, what, profoundly affected, influenced by some of these ideas swirling around?
Well, the other way around, I think. The actions of the levelers were very much, yeah, these ideas were swirling around, and Edward Cook was affected by them, and he also helped to transform them. And then the levelers and others used his ideas to give force and substance to this transformation of Magna Carta into a document of modern liberties, so that it'll be cited in Connecticut, in New York, in Maryland, in the colonies where English people settled.
Peter Linebaugh joins us today on Against the Grain. He's a professor of history at the University of Toledo, and one of his books is The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. It was published by University of California Press. We have a link to that book, as well as to a number of other things by Peter Linebaugh, on our website, againstthegrain.org. My name is C.S. Song. Well, if we move to the U.S., the nascent United States, in fact, the English colonies before the states were formed, Thomas Paine had a certain understanding of the Magna Carta, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Tell us about that and about the degree to which Magna Carta's ideas and principles were incorporated into documents of his and the document of the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, Thomas Paine in February 1776 recommended that the United States, if it was to continue its revolutionary independence war from England, would need to have a Magna Carta of its own. And it was that suggestion that impelled the Continental Congress to ask Thomas Jefferson to draft such a Magna Carta, which, and the result was the Declaration of Independence. That's the simple, direct answer. But Thomas Paine was a Republican. That is, he was an anti-monarchist. And here, to be an anti-monarchist meant that he was against hierarchy at every level of social existence, which he also thought was in Magna Carta, though subsequent historians have not always found it there.
If we can return to the commons, which is one focus of Magna Carta, you argue in this book that to think of the commons as a natural resource, and I know a lot of people who do, right? We think of things that are available to all or should be available to all in the sense of maybe air or water. So to think of the commons as a natural resource is misleading at best and dangerous at worst. Why is that?
Because of alienation. Because human society consists of our mutual labors with each other. Our mutual labors with each other are mediated by products of the earth. And to separate those products and that labor from us is dangerous because, it's dangerous. I think we express ourselves through this commonality, to use the Luddites term, and that social expression, of which I think the household is the most vivid and the kitchen is the most vivid architectural image to understand the commons and commoning. You know, whether you're baking at home, whether you're helping your mother, whether you're responsible for the salad while someone else is doing the soup, or whether someone is washing up and another's doing the drying, all of this is a place where cooperation and commoning takes place. And we don't separate it from, you know, the lettuce or the lentils or the dishes. And I think we can scale up from that and understand that our family life, our kinship groups, depend on the cooperation of labor, and that labor itself is understood in a concrete ways with the wood or with the different substances and tools that we realize our social humanity. That if we separate ourselves from the world, we begin a process of alienation that results, I think, in insanity.
Commoning as a verb, in other words, commoning as a process, as opposed to perhaps the commons as a thing out there.
Precisely, C.S.
What current movements of commoning most encourage you?
Well, at Zuccotti Park last fall, at Occupy Wall Street, quickly people found it necessary to provide security for one another. And a women's safe space was established. People found it necessary to eat, and soon a community kitchen was established. People found it necessary to while away the time, which otherwise was tinted with fear or tension, and music was established. Many people wish to increase their knowledge of their activities of Wall Street and the history of capitalism, and a library was established. So here, for knowledge, security, food, people were commoning. These, I think, is the most powerful recent examples of commoning. One place in New York where it failed, and I think was a question around the world, or around the nation anyway, around the Occupy movement, was the pee question. That is, where could people go to the bathroom?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure how that was solved in different places.
A vital question indeed. Let me begin wrapping up by asking you a little bit about this new PM Press edition of E.P. Thompson's biography of William Morris. It's entitled William Morris, Romantic to Revolutionary. You wrote the foreword, the introduction to that volume. Of course, William Morris, the iconic 19th century designer and craftsman and scholar and agitator and writer and poet, and E.P. Thompson, the iconic British historian of the working class. What drew Thompson to the writings of Morris? Because obviously this isn't kind of a detached biography. Thompson was very invested in many of Morris's ideas.
Yes, William Morris is the first artist of major reputation to stake his life and energy wholeheartedly, 100% with a revolutionary working class. And he did this in the opposition to the ruling class or bourgeoisie of England. This is what attracted Thompson to Morris, and I think it's also what can attract us to Morris's art, to Morris's practices. Morris was a great communist, you know, long before the Soviet debacle, long before the Russian Revolution. And Morris lived through factional quarrels with Fabians, with reformists, with socialists, with anarchists, and remained a revolutionary communist to the end of his days. He didn't fall into bitterness, and his imagination, his labors of writing, of poetry, of essays, of speeches, remain a tremendous source that we need very deeply now, because the thing about Morris is that he was green. Not only was he a red in the red revolutionary sense of the working class, but also he was green. He loved the planet. He loved the other creatures, the other forms of life on this earth, and wished to preserve them. And that part of England which where you can still roam about, that part of England which still adheres to some green notions, really owes it to William Morris.
And what did Morris hate about modern civilization? Was it primarily civilization's impact on the green spaces?
The shoddy of it. He thought everything is not built to last. It's all built for profit. He hated shoddy deeply. He thought that every worker should be an artist and every artist should be a worker. And he had a completely different conception of work, of labor, and of the planet. And I really recommend us all, I think we should re-study his great utopian book, News from Nowhere.
So the new edition of E.P. Thompson's book, William Morris, Romantic to Revolutionary, is out from PM Press with a foreword by my guest, Peter Linebaugh. He's a professor of social history at the University of Toledo. We've also been talking about his new pamphlet, Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, and his book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, which won many prizes and is a delight to read, as many of Peter's books are. Peter, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
And we have a minute. I'm going to read from the last paragraph of the Magna Carta Manifesto by Peter Linebaugh. Three propositions leap forth concerning the mass, the ideas, and the willingness to contribute to that planetary common. One, there are more proletarians, both relatively and absolutely, on the face of the earth now than ever before in history. So even as the conservatives trumpet, quote, the end of history, the class that can abolish all classes is a democratic possibility. Two, there are active movements of human commoning and worldwide demands to share wealth and safeguard common resources on every continent, from movements of urban gardening to transcontinental oil swaps, efforts of actual autonomous communism. Three, there is a militant movement that wages war against American imperialism. These propositions demand that we be up and doing. As left to themselves, they spell defeat or disaster. The Charters of Liberties, or the Magna Carta, do not call for regrets or nostalgia, and certainly not for restoration of medievalism. Of course, it is not our duty to fulfill their promise, though they remain ready, as this book has tried to indicate, to help us to fulfill ours.
Thank you to C.S. Sung of Against the Grain for that recording. Their show archive is linked in from our website, or you can go there directly via againstthegrain.org. Now, one of the key weaknesses, I think, of the current social system, which is being globalized at a rate of knots, is its determination to be hierarchical and top-down, whilst not even admitting that's how things are supposed to work. It's got this line about democracy. Now, as an illustration of the unfairness and the inflexibility of the system as it works in practice, let's hear the following piece. This is from earlier this year by Red Eye from Vancouver on the privatization of prisons in Canada.
Privatized prisons, Christy Clark's housing plan for the poor. That message was printed on a banner that was hung at the construction site of the new Surrey Remand Center last Tuesday. About 100 people staged a protest at that construction site. They then marched to Surrey RCMP office to stage a speak-out against what they refer to as the mass incarceration agenda. I'm joined in the studio by Iannis Ormond. Iannis is an organizer with VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, which is based here in the downtown east side. VANDU led the organizing of that rally along with the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society. Iannis is also a host of People's Health Radio, which broadcasts here on Co-op every second Wednesday from 1 to 2. Welcome into the studio on a weekend,
Iannis. Thanks for having me.
So this new Surrey Remand Center isn't the only private prison project in BC underway right now. There's also going to be one in the Okanagan. What are the contract details of these private prisons?
The Surrey Remand Center is a 216-cell facility, so it's a large remand center. The price tag is about $136 million, and that one has been contracted out to a consortium led by Brookfield International, which is a huge Canadian property management corporation that manages $150 billion in assets worldwide or something, just gigantic. The Brookfield contract is to build, design, and maintain the facility. So we haven't turned the corner that they have in the U.S. where we have the actual management and prison guards employed by a private company. But what we're seeing is a creeping privatization that's happening within these Canadian prisons and the introduction of profit as an element of our prison system, or a ramping up of profit. The second facility, there's no contract for yet. It was recently announced. It's going to be in the Okanagan in Nirasoyus. It's a 350-cell remand center. So these are facilities that are designed to hold people for short periods of time with no rehabilitation, no programs, 23 hours in your cell. It's really warehousing. It's going to be built on the lands of the Soyuz Indian Band. It was actually rejected by Penticton. They had a plebiscite, and it was rejected by Penticton rejected hosting it. So it's being built on native land in Soyuz. It's a $200 million contract. So again, a huge expenditure by the provincial government. And we're expecting that one also to be a private-public partnership. So again, the introduction of this profit motive into our prison system.
How will that profit motive work compared to, say, the U.S. model?
Well, we're not yet at a point where you have kind of contracts for holding specific prisoners for specific periods of time, but these are long-term lucrative contracts, and there's also some recent ones in Ontario. So the new Toronto South Detention Center is a $1.1 billion contract to design, build, and maintain, again, this giant super jail in Toronto. So there's big corporations making money off of these contracts, and it creates a lobby for incarcerating more people and keeping more people in jail for longer is the concern. And we also think it's the thin edge of the wedge in terms of moving towards a more explicit privatized prison model. And certainly the minister in charge, Vic Taves, will not deny that they're looking very seriously at prison privatization at the federal level.
What implications would an expanded private sector role in the prison system mean for the incarceration of people?
Well, I think that I mean, we're not concerned only about the privatization element. We're concerned about the general expansion of prisons in Canada and incarceration. And what we're seeing across Canada now is there are more than 60 individual prisons that are either being expanded or built across the country. They're building 9,000 spots, of which about 7,000 are, again, remand centers. This is short-term warehousing for people who are not being convicted of murder or serious crimes that you would do longer sentences for, right? So it's a massive expansion of the prison system, and the privatization element, again, creates a kind of corporate lobby for these policies and creates, I think, something that is abhorrent to most of us, the idea that somehow you're going to make money off of the human misery of locking up people who are overwhelmingly poor people. There's a quote, a recent quote from Hugh Siegel, who's a conservative senator, who said in an op-ed, people living under the poverty line in Canada make up less than 10% of the total population, but approaching 100% of the prison population, if you actually break it down and look at the demographics of who's in prison.
Yeah, well, actually, let's look further into those demographics. Like, what sectors of the population, well, within that 100% of low-income people, what are the different sectors of the population represented in prisons?
Yeah, well, one of the things that came up at the rally was if you're poor, and if you're Aboriginal, and if you're a drug user, that's three strikes, and these cells have a prison with a cell with your name on them. So that's really who's in prison right now. It's poor people. Native folks are massively over incarcerated, so they make up about 4% of the total Canadian population, but around 22% of the prison population. People of color, so particularly blacks or African Canadians, make up, again, about 2.5% of the total population, but 10% of the prison population. We see a lot of people going to jail either for drug crimes or for drug-related crimes. So people who are addicted to illicit drugs, often in response to histories of collective and personal oppression and tragedy, are moving through these prisons like a revolving door. And again, there's actually cuts to any programs which you might be seen as rehabilitation or community integration. Those things are being cut by the federal government, but these remand centers are being built on a massive scale.
What are the actual charges that land people in prison? Like, your organization has a large membership of people who use illicit drugs. Mm-hmm. What kind of charges are they actually facing?
So the scary thing is that a very small proportion of charges laid in courts in Canada are for violent crimes. And there's a lot of people who are going to prison for what they call administration of justice charges. So something like 25% of the charges laid in Canada and somewhat less than that of people actually in prison at any given time are there for things like failure to appear at a court date, breach of a undertaking, breach of probation. So these are charges that are related mostly to being poor and not being able to navigate the legal system, honestly. Because if you have money, you're organized, you have a lawyer, you deal with these things. If you're extremely poor and marginalized, you have a lot harder time. And those are the people who end up with these charges and go to prison for them. So what we've seen in the downtown east side is you can get a ticket for vending, selling salvaged goods on the sidewalk, miss your court date, get a fine, get a failure to appear at your court date, and end up getting picked up by the cops and actually put in prison over a vending ticket. So that's the kind of thing that we're seeing, like that the prisons are being filled up with. It's largely not for crimes against people. It's largely for these kinds of procedural crimes and property crimes, which frankly, in many cases, are crimes of poverty and survival strategies for poor people.
Now, in organizing the protest, you partnered with the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, and you mentioned the overwhelming disproportion of Indigenous folks in prisons. What kind of analysis do you have coming out of organizations like that about why such large amounts of Aboriginal people are in prison?
Mm-hmm.